Well, in the meantime.
People might have thought that this sure starts at 6:15.
Yeah.
So they'll come a few minutes later. Okay. So today we're going to do Emunas Videos by Rasaji Gaon. So now we're going a little bit backwards in history. Basically, we're going to divide this, all these shirim, into generic periods, right? The medieval period, and then we'll get to the modern period, but I'm not going in chronological order. So now we're going back to the earliest chronologically that we've touched so far. So, Rav Sadia Gaon, born in 882, right? We're several hundred years before anybody else. It's one of the earliest systematic philosophical works that we have. Like most of the works we've done so far, they were written in
Arabic.
Good. Hence, again, I give it to you in English. So he was the Gaon. Gaon means?
Genius.
Gaon does mean genius. Now, what does the formal term Gaon mean? Not genius. What?
From the Gaonic period.
Actually, no. It means he was a member of the Gaonate, which was the political body that ran the Jews in the Arabic lands. The Gaonate, very technically, were the Rosh Yeshiva of... The people in the Gaonic period were the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura and Pumbedisa. Like the yeshiva you find in the Gemara, the Gaonate, right, continued those yeshivot. Rav Sadia Gaon was the Rosh Yeshiva of, I think it was Sura. Yes, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura, right? Like, so the same Sura from the Gemara, Rav Sadia Gaon becomes Rosh Yeshiva of Sura, right? They are in that area, right? They're in Baghdad, they're in that area. So Rav Sadia Gaon is a very, very powerful Gaon. He, again, moves from Egypt, comes to Baghdad. He's most famous for his, in terms of political power, for his calendrical dispute. There were several hundred years where the question of whether the Bavli was more binding than the Yerushalmi or not was still an open question. It really, came to a fore under Rav Sadia, who in a calendrical dispute with the Gaon Eretz Yisrael, Rav Avraham ben Meir, he fought and eventually basically beat him down and sort of established the power. He also got into fights with the other... In each Gaonic period, there were two leaders, basically, the Rosh Yeshiva and the Reish Galuta, or the Exilarch, and he got into a huge fight with the Exilarch as well. He was a very... Takif personality, very, very strong-willed person. His book that we're going to do, Emunot Videot, is the earliest extant systematic work on Jewish philosophy, really, basically. And he wrote a lot to polemicize against the Karaites, who were very powerful. And he's influenced tremendously by the philosophical culture there in amongst the Arab cultures. He writes in the style of some of the Arabic philosophers, the Mutakallimun, and the like. Okay, I know we said we'd cut down on biography, but if people are going to be late, so I'll give a few minutes of biography. I'm less late. So that's basically what we're talking about. Okay, so his work is Emunot Videot, a mistranslation, but what can you do? The Arabic. Translates, if you actually translate the Arabic straight, it would be emunot ve'emunot. There is no distinction for the Arabic word in Hebrew. So emunot ve'deot, which is then translated into English into, the books of beliefs and opinions, is not what he meant. It just isn't, right? The word in Arabic, ammana, right, is, and whatever cognate word, they're very, very close, and there just is no... There's just no parallel in Hebrew. There just isn't.
And in English?
In English, maybe there is, but then they've translated from the Hebrew, so what can you do? This is according to my medieval Jewish history professor, who, he's one of the oldest people in the field, shall we say. He's like 95 years old. I think, actually, 95. Now, maybe 96 now? he was students of Harry Wolfson, if you know who that is. Harry Wolfson was like the first Jewish studies professor in Harvard in like the turn of the 20th century. Like, he's old, he knows the field. It was a very interesting experience with him in class. It was like when we had class on Buber, he gave class based on his conversations with Buber. It was very intense. When we gave an Alech Man, he said, Martin Buber, we'll get to him, maybe, I don't know, one of the modern Jewish philosophers. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you've heard of? Yes. So when we had shir on halachic, when he had class on halachic man, he said, when I first gave class, halachic man had not been published, and I had to get permission to photocopy it, and I tried to convince Soloveitchik to publish it in 1953, maybe? I don't know. He was on the, like, Professor Hyman was on the board of people who reviewed Rabbi Lamb's dissertation. Rabbi Lamb, I think, is ABC. So he knows the field. He's been in the field for a very long time. I don't know Arabic, but this is what he tells me. Okay, so that's a little bit about Rav Sadia Gaon. So now to the work. So we're going to do two ideas from Rav Sadia Gaon. The first one we're going to run through very quickly, but it's important because we've already seen it in Rabbeinu Bachya, and then we'll get to something unique. Okay, I mean, really, this is unique in Rav Sadia, but since we're going out of order, we did Rabbeinu Bachya first. So if you remember, one of the big things we talked about in Rabbeinu Bachya was the epistemological issues, right? What is a legitimate way of knowing things? So if you remember, he quoted from the introduction to Emunos Videos from Rav Sadia Gaon, what are the different ways we know things? So, in Kvar we're doing Rav Sadia Gaon, we might as well see it inside. Though he adds a little bit to it. So let's just read through it very quickly. Okay, this introduction, again, forgive me for the landscape, but you'll see the PDF, so I just had to keep cutting it so that it would take a normal number of pages. So it just ended up being that way. Okay, so now that we've opened with a brief praise and tribute of our Lord, I will preface this book, which I intend to write, with a report of the causes of errors that beset some people in their investigations, how these errors can be eliminated, so people can fully attain the object of their investigations. Moreover, why some errors have taken hold of people such that their thought and fancy affirm them as true. I shall first report the causes of error that beset some men. I say then that intelligibles are based upon sensibles. Now doubts, meaning, right, things that you know in your mind come from things that you perceive, right, through the senses. Right? Remember, right, we saw this already, that one of the ways that we perceive things is through the senses. Now doubts may arise concerning something apprehended by sense through one of two causes, either because the person who is inquiring has an inadequate idea of the object of the investigation, or because he is casual and perfunctory in his observation and research. Take the case of a person who is looking for someone called Reuven ben Yaakov. He may be in doubt whether he has found him for one of two reasons, either because his knowledge of Reuven is inadequate, since he never met him before and therefore does not know him, or because he may casually assume that some other person that he sees is Reuven. By taking matters lightly and neglecting to make proper inquiries, he seeks him half-heartedly and with little application. He will never recognize him. We can say the same for things apprehended by our intellect. Here again, doubts arise from one of two causes, either because the person who seeks intellectual knowledge is unfamiliar with the methods of demonstration, he judges a bad proof to be correct and a good one incorrect, or he knows the right methods of investigation, but he treats the matter lightly and carelessly, rushing to a conclusion about some object of knowledge before having completed the art of investigation concerning it. The case is worse when both deficiencies are combined to the same person, that is to say, when the person is not acquainted with the art of investigation and, in addition, lacks patience to achieve what he can truly know about. And the case is still worse when he adds to these deficiencies a third, namely that the inquirer has no clear idea as to what he really wishes to know. He resembles a man who is unacquainted with the art of weighing, with the shape of the scales and weights, and with the amount of money owed him by his debtor. Even if his debt is paid, it will not be clear to him that he had received the full payment, and if he took less than owed to him, he might think that he had cheated his debtor. Right, so first thing he notes is, most important thing to know anything is three things. Pretty straightforward. Three things you need to know things. You need to know what you're looking for. You need to know how to look for it. And you gotta look for it carefully. Right? Three things, right? If I know what I'm looking for, but I don't do it carefully, then I'm not gonna be accurate. If I know how to look, but I don't know what I'm looking for, I'm not gonna find it. Right? So those are the three things that he says, right? You need to know what? Right, so you need to know what you're looking for. You need to know how to look for it, and you have to be careful when you look for it, right? Meaning, right, if you can know what you're looking for, you can know what you should do to find it, but if you're not careful, right, I know that in order to figure out how much money I owe, I have to add up everything I've done this year, right? All the things I bought this year, right? That's fine, but if I, haphazardly, throw my receipts and, you know, throw some of them in the garbage and stuff some of them in my pocket. At the end of the year, I try to find whatever I can. So I know that what I should be doing is taking all my receipts and adding it up, right? But I just wasn't careful. So I may know what I'm supposed to do and what I'm looking for, but I didn't do it well, right? So the three things are: you need to know how to look, right? You need to know the process. You need to do that carefully, and you know what you're looking for. Because if you don't understand what you're even looking for, so right, you don't realize what you're looking for at the end is a number, is a monetary number, right? You wouldn't understand what you're doing. So the same thing he says is true in beliefs, right? I need to have an idea of what I'm looking for, so I'll recognize it when I see it, right? Like some vague idea. I need to know what it is considered a legitimate process by which I understand it, and I need to do that with integrity. Right? Carefully, with integrity. Yes? I think this is pretty straightforward. Yeah? Okay. So now, what's the obvious next question? What am I looking for? How do I do it? Right? This is, right? This is his general thing. So now he says, convictions are of two kinds, true and false. And this is pretty, he's very, like, very systematic here, right? You can't really argue on what he said so far. Convictions are of two kinds, true and false. A true conviction consists in believing a thing to be as it really is. Namely, the much is much, the little is little, the existent as existent, and the non-existent as non-existent. A false conviction, on the other hand, consists in believing a thing to be the opposite of what it actually is. Such as that much is little, and little is much, and white is black, and black is white, and what exists is non-existent, and what is non-existent exists. The praiseworthy wise man is he who makes a principle of the truth of things and bases his convictions thereon. Notwithstanding his wisdom, he relies only on what is deserving of trust and is wary wherever caution is in order. The reprehensible fool, on the other hand, is he who makes a principle of his own conviction and assumes that the truth of things results from his convictions. Right? Notwithstanding his ignorance, he trusts in what should be shunned and shuns what is deserving of trust. All this is burned out by Scripture, which says, a wise man fears and shuns evil, but a dullard rushes in confidently. Right? So now, he starts and says, right, very simply, right, wise people try to find the truth. False people, and then base their convictions on the truth. False people start with what they're convinced of, and then they assume that whatever they happen to be convinced of is true. Right? This is part of his question of what is proper process. Well, part of proper process is first proving something before you're sure of it. Right? Don't start that you're sure of it and then try to prove it. Now that we have finished what we saw fit to add to our first statement, we ought to mention the principles that lead us to truth. And now he says more specifically, what are the ways? And again, we saw this in Ravina Bachya. So what are the principles that lead us to truth and are conducive to certainty? The principles of all science and the mainspring of all knowledge. We will discuss them as much as befits the aim of this book. We say there are three such conducive principles. The first is observational knowledge, right? Meaning, what's observational knowledge? Remember this? Senses, right? The first way you know things is very simply. You see it, you feel it, you touch it, you taste it, you hear it, etc. The second is intellectual knowledge, right? Remember, deductive knowledge, right? Things that I, right, figure out through my mind. The third is knowledge obtained from necessary inference. We shall explain each of these principles separately. We say that observational knowledge is that which a man apprehends with one of his senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, or touch. Intellectual knowledge is what which arises solely through the human intellect, such as the approval of truthfulness and disapproval of mendacity. Knowledge obtained from necessary inference is that which, if not accepted as true, entails the impossibility of a sensible or intelligible. Since there is no way to reject either of these, the individual is compelled to regard the matter as being correct. Right. So the right between those two, between intellectual knowledge and knowledge obtained through necessary inference, he's, you know, without getting to all the distinctions of which is which, he means deductive knowledge, inductive knowledge, and all those things. At some level, strong intuition is probably included in there, right? A strong intuition that this is correct, right? This is right, this is moral, right? Some combination of induction, deduction, and strong first principles, shall we say, right? As, you know, Descartes makes a big deal of this, that we have first principles, right? Without which we wouldn't understand the world at all. The world would not be comprehensible, right? There's a certain level of intuition that's necessary. So all those are in one of these two categories. Thus, we are forced to assume that a man possesses a soul, though we have not seen it, in order not to deny its manifest activity. Now we find there are many people who deny these principles. We'll leave them for a minute. And then he just adds that the fourth, just skip to the last sentence, to them, however, we add a fourth conducive principle, which we have derived by means of the other three, and which has thus become for us a further principle, namely the validity of authentic tradition. Right? So we saw this in Rambam, in addition to the three direct forms of knowledge, right? Sense, perception, and all the different things that, you know, induction, deduction, intuition, and the like, those proofs allow us to prove the Torah, which we're not going to get into his proofs of such things, but allow us to prove the Torah once we've gotten to that point, so then anything we then learn from the tradition has been itself proven by these three. Right? So it's an outgrowth. It's once you have proven the authenticity of your tradition, you can then derive things from the tradition. Okay, so this is the introduction to Rav Sadia Gaon. The two main points you should take out of it are, one is the three necessary things to know things, right? One is to know what you're looking for, second is to know how to look for it, the third is to be diligent when you do, and the second issue is what is that process? What are the four ways you know things? So the three basic ways that are true to all knowledge in the world are observation and induction, deduction, intuition, right? All those things that we consider, right, things that you derive straight from the mind, and then we use those to prove the Torah, and there we can deduce things from tradition. Okay, so far we're okay. Right, this is important just because, remember, this is the first systematic. This is really the first systematic work of Jewish philosophy of this era. So he's setting out the ABCs. And as you saw, Rabbeinu Bachya just picks up from Rav Sadia when he's writing his own thing. Right? He copies this. And you'll find similar things in many of the philosophers. So it is important, right, that we set this out at the beginning. Rav Sadia Gaon attempts to have a very systematic work. The work is divided basically into his claims and then the pulmosim, which are his sort of polemics against the counterclaims. And that's how each of the sections in Emunas Vadeos is divided up. Okay, so that's one. Now, next thing we're going to do, and this is what we'll spend most of the time on, is probably his most famous claim and some subclaims about the nature of mitzvot. Right, so we already saw Rabbeinu Bachya running several hundred years later that there are two main categories of mitzvot. How does he divide the mitzvot? Yeah, chovot halavavot and chovot ha'evarim, right? Duties of the heart, duties of the mind, of the limbs, duty of the body. So Rav Sadia Gaon is going to divide mitzvot in a totally different way. So let's try it a different way, okay? What Rabbeinu Bachya, when he decided to make different categories of mitzvot, how was he dividing them, right? What criteria was he using to make the categories? This is not a trick question, right? In taxonomy, whenever you're categorizing anything, right, you have to figure out what the relevant, right, what's relevant for the distinctions you're making such that you make the distinctions you make. So what is he, right, how is he describing them? Yeah, I'll give you an example, right? Modern science, right? When we talk about birds, we mean, what do we mean? We mean very specific, what? Right, we mean feathers, we mean hollow bones, right? So according to our definition, certain things like bats are not birds. Chazal, or the Torah for that matter, right, said that bats, anataleif, is a bird. Who's right? There's no right and wrong. It depends what you're categorizing, right? It depends, right? If you have a, right, if you're categorizing based on, you know, do things fly, and you call a bird anything that then flies, so bat is a bird. If you're categorizing based on something with feathers and hollow bones, so bat is not, right? It's not a right or wrong question. It's a question of how did you choose to organize it, right? What are the criteria you're using, right? It's just different criteria. So Rabbeinu Bachya, when he came up with these two categories, what was he basing it on? Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's just saying practically, how do we experience these mitzvot, right? Do I act on them or do I feel them? Do I think them? That's it, right? Very, very straightforward, right? There's another way we can divide mitzvot, though, and we've hinted at this, so we haven't fleshed it out, which is not how do I experience them, but epistemologically, how do I know them? Right? How do I know them to be obligatory? Right? That's a different categorization, right? So if you had to divide the mitzvot into, right, epistemologically, we talked about this a little bit the first week with Ramban, right? How would you divide mitzvot? Okay, so how would you, right? Now if we, in English, right? Chukim
mishpatim. Mitzvot that we know the reasons to, mitzvot that we don't know the reasons to.
Good, right? Or to put it even a little bit sharper, right? And we'll see this is what he says, right? Mitzvot that I need revelation for, I mean mitzvot I wouldn't know without the Torah, and mitzvot I would know without the Torah, right? That's another way of saying chukim u'mishpatim at some level, right? There are slight distinctions, right? In Hebrew, this is commonly referred to as mitzvot sichliot and mitzvot shimiot. Right? Mitzvot that find their place in the intellect, that's sichliot, or mitzvot shimiot, from shema, right, from shema, from hearing, right, mitzvot that their power derived not from inherent logic, but from the fact they're commanded, right? So this distinction, this epistemological distinction, right, and the philosophical moral implications of that distinction is probably the most famous claim in Emunos Videos. So that's what we're going to do, okay? So the two classes of law, laws of reason and laws of revelation, mitzvot shimiot, sichliot, however you want to call it. After these introductory remarks, and if you want, you know, I can give you the link for longer PDFs. I've cut out, you know, key passages, but like these whole chapters are mostly translated. You can also tell which ones are more famous because those are the ones I can find translations of online by search enough because someone will have translated them. After these introductory remarks, I now come to the subject proper. I declare that our Lord, be he exalted and glorified, has informed us through the words of his prophets that he wishes us to lead a religious life by following the religion which he instituted for us. The religion contains laws which he has prescribed for us, and which is our duty to keep and to fulfill in sincerity. As it said, this day the Lord thy God commanded thee to do the statutes and ordinances, right? God commanded you, chukim v'mishpatim. Thou shalt therefore observe them and do them with all thy heart, right? And you'll do it, b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, with all your heart, with all your soul. His messengers established these laws for us by wondrous signs and miracles, and we commenced to keep and fulfill them forthwith. Later we found that speculation confirmed the necessity of the law for us. It would, however, not have been appropriate to leave us to our own advices. So, just to go back to the beginning, right? What does he do in this first paragraph? Just to show you that he's very consistent in what he said he would do in his introduction. Right? How does he establish the legitimacy of mitzvos?
It's okay.
Well, three ways. Psukim, right, which is tradition, and then
miracles.
Signs and miracles, which is the senses. And then, later we found that speculation confirms the necessity of law for us, which is logic, right? So, he's very true to his model, right? He says, I can prove, right? This is how I think you need to prove it. This is how we did prove it. There were miracles which proved it by senses. It makes sense. That proves it by logic. And then, once we've done that, we believe the Torah, and now we know it through tradition. It is desirable that I should explain which matters and aspects of divine law speculation confirms as necessary. I maintain, so now he says, okay, so I just said that logic tells us to do the mitzvos independently, but that's not necessarily true. And now he divides them. I maintain that reason bids us respond to every right. So we'll get to the cool classes of law, right? Now he wants to set up what would it mean? What is the logic for mitzvot in general, right? So again, we'll get to his distinction of mitzvot shimiot and sichliot. But if I ask you, is it logical to keep the mitzvot shimiot, right? The laws that we only know through revelation. Well, depends what you mean. Is it logical? Again, think about the introduction. Is it logical?
It's not logical.
Think about the introduction.
Is revelation meaning ones that have been revealed to us?
Right. So
it is logical.
It's logical, but not directly logical. Right? So, right, he doesn't mean logical, not logical. He means independently logical. Right? Remember, he has this distinction. He has the first three principles and then the fourth. Right? So, things that we only know through tradition are logical insofar as we've proven the tradition, but they're not inherently logical. I mean, I wouldn't have known them independently, but they're still logical. Now, beyond that, he says, there, one could still in his mind distinguish two types of things, right? You said chukim and mishpatim, but it's not totally true, because they are, right, even chukim, are they illogical? Well, maybe not, because they might not have specific logic, but they might have generic logic, right? It might be that, okay, I wouldn't have picked this over that, but the notion that there should be law makes sense, right? When we're talking about is a mitzvah logical, we mean that on two planes. Right? One is this specific, right? Like we could say, kashrus makes sense, right? But it didn't have to be, you know, that if not kosher food falls into kosher food, it becomes batel 1 in 60. It could have been 1 in 50. It could have been 1 in 70, right? The details may not make sense. And when we get to the Rambam, we'll see this fleshed out. So the first thing he does is, before he even makes the sharp distinction, he says, let me give you the broad strokes of why, what are the reasons for mitzvot in general? Okay? So one, I maintain that reason bids us respond to every benefactor, either by returning his kindness if he is in need of it, or by offering thanks if he is not in need of recompense. Now, since this is a dictate of reason itself, it would not have been fitting for the Creator, be he exalted and glorified, to waive this right in respect of himself, but it was necessary that he should command his creatures to worship and to render thanks unto him for having created them. So, first thing he says is that what is one of the basic reasons for all mitzvot? For everything in life. Yeah, or Hakar Zatov, right? Because I would do that to everybody. So what does he already tell you? That ritual law in general, right? Ritual law, right? Like Karbanot v'chadome, right? Is there any inherent logical reason for one Karbanot over another? Maybe not. But broadly speaking, right? It makes sense, right? God, if a human being... It's, you know, Rabbi Liebtag's like saying this all the time, right? The pasuk says, lo yira'e p'nei reikam, right? You can't come to the base of Mikdash empty-handed. Now, when you go out for a meal, I mean, yeshiva guys go out for a meal, they often feel like they should bring something. Kol guys, ramen, we really don't need, you know, bottles of wine and cakes. We just don't, right? People bring it because, you know, it's mikubal, right? You know, you bring something, you don't have to, but like, people feel like they should, right? It makes sense. Right? If someone was taking you into the house for a week, you know, you probably should at least give them a thank you. You know, like, it makes sense. Okay, how you choose, right? Do you get flowers, do you get cake, do you get cookies, do you get a bottle of wine? Whatever. There's no, like, particular reason to pick one or the other, but the notion that you could should show your appreciation in some way, that's, like, logical, right? So he's saying, even those mitzvot shimiyot, right, there's an inherent logic to, like, ritual law, which is that we owe thanks to God. That's one. Two, reason further lays down that the wise man should not permit himself to be vilified and treated with contempt. Right? Second thing he says is, it's not right for the lawmaker to allow himself to, for allow people to insult him. It doesn't make sense, right? It is similarly necessary that the Creator should forbid his servants to treat him in this way. Three, reason further prescribes human beings should be forbidden to trespass upon one another's rights by any sort of aggression. Right? In addition to, now, your relationship with God, the relationship with other people, right? People, it doesn't make sense that you should be able to hurt others. It is likewise necessary that the wise should not permit them to act in such a way. Four, reason furthermore permits a wise man to employ a workman for any kind of work and pay him his wages for the sole purpose of allowing him to earn something. Right? Now, this is really where he goes straight to the mitzvah shimiyot. He says, in addition to all of this, sometimes it makes sense for someone to do what?
To give reward.
Yeah, to give reward, right? This happens, right? You know, I know that, you know, the company my father works at, the owners are big Baalei Chesed, and there are people who at some point are just too old to really work, but they need the salary. And the owner, he's rich enough, he allows the people to come into work, and he pays them simply for being at their desk, for showing up, right? Because, you know, look, they've had a relationship with him for years. They were devoted employees. They still need the money. He can, you know, give up the salary. He doesn't, you know, the extra $50,000 to him is no big deal, right? He brings in, you know, $35 million salary a year, right? He literally created the position of, you know, sitting in your desk, I don't know, answering the phone or whatever, for the sole purpose of giving the guy a salary, right? Sometimes people do that. That's, you know, if someone already has a relationship with you, sometimes you do that. You know, right? You want to give something to your child, but you don't want him to feel entitled to it. So you give him a slight chore. You know, you really want your child to have the great dessert that you made. Okay, so you come up with a rule, right? You'll get dessert if you have dinner, right? Okay, right? There's a certain logic to having dinner, but also, like, okay, you make him do something, right? So that he doesn't feel like he's getting it for free, right? He gets into the mode of earning things, right? So he says the same is true with God, right? Sin is a matter which results in benefit to the workman, causes no harm to the employer. The employer, like, he doesn't care. He wants the guy to benefit. So we put these 4 points together. Their total is tantamount to a summary of the laws which our Lord has commanded us. The first thing he says, this is the summary of Kol HaTorah Kula. That is to say, he imposed upon us the duty of knowing and serving him with a sincere heart. The prophet said, and thou, Solomon, my son, know that the God of thy father, and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. Then he forbade us to hurl at him insult and abuse, though it caused him no harm, seeing that it would not be consonant with wisdom to permit it. Thus it is said, whoever curseth God shall bear a sin. He did not permit to trespass on one another's rights, nor to defraud one another. It said, you shall not steal, you shall not deal falsely, nor lie to one another. And now he makes his famous distinction, right? So first he said, look, kol Torah kula has a certain inherent logic to it. But within that, there's still two categories. Because there are those laws that we would have intuitively known, right? And those which we wouldn't. So he said the first three groups of laws and their subdivisions form the first of the two classes of law. The first group of the three includes humbleness before God, worship, standing up in his presence, etc. All this written in the law. The second group includes the prohibition of adultery, swearing falsely by his name, describing him by derogatory attributes. All this written in the law. The third group belongs to the practice of justice, truth-telling, equity, impartiality, avoidance of homicide, adultery, theft, tale-bearing, and trickery against one's fellow. All the command that the believer should love his neighbor as he loves himself, and whatever involved in these precepts, all this is written in the law. In regards to all the things which commands us to do, he has implanted approval of them in our reason. And so it's interesting that he put both Binah al-Mukhavir's Binah al-Mukham in reason. But he said, look, all these Pachori Yoter make sense. And in regard to all things which he forbids us to do, he has implanted disapproval of them in our reason, as said in the Book of Wisdom, wisdom being identical with reason, from my mouth shall utter truth, and wickedness and abomination of my lips. The second class of laws consists of matters regarding which reason passes no judgment in the way, either approval or disapproval, so far as their essence is concerned. But our Lord has given us an abundance of such commandments and prohibitions in order to increase our reward and happiness through them. As I said, the Lord is pleased for its righteousness' sake to make the law great and glorious, right? That's, what is that? What's that pasuk? Hashem chafetz l'man tzidko yagdil Torah v'yadir. Right, that which belongs to the things commanded by God assumes the character of good, and that which belongs to the things forbidden by him assumes the character of evil on account of the service thereby performed. Thus, the second class of law is in fact joined to the first class. In spite of this, one cannot fail upon closer examination to find in some slender moral benefits and rational basis tagged against the greater moral benefits and firmer rational basis attached to the first class of law. So here he sets out his basic theory. Right? So what's his theory, right? It's more subtle than I originally said, right? Now let's flesh out what it actually is. So what does he say, right? What is the distinction between mitzvot?
Reason and reward.
Right. It's things that either, right? Again, I said it was an epistemological thing, right? Fundamentally for him, it's about epistemology. It's, the categories are things that make sense inherently and things that, not things necessarily, oversimplified, not things I could have figured out necessarily, but things that that at least make sense logically, and then things which don't reason doesn't pass much. At first he says reason has no opinion of it, but then he backtracks and says even those, once they're commanded, I can find a logic in them, right? So it's not really things that have no logic. It's, again, it's epistemological. It's things that reason could have figured out and therefore immediately approves of or disapproves of. And then things which logically I wouldn't have known, but post facto I could find some logic in it. But he doesn't mean rational, irrational, because as he said, right, what does he say? There's a super rational system that explains the whole system on top of it, right? I mean, it's not that the irrational laws, again, it's purely a question of how do I know them, right? Because, as he said, there are four logical reasons for any commandments to exist, right? To allow someone to give thanks, to prevent somebody from from hurting the person he owes his life to, right? Prevent people from hurting each other, and then there are laws which are created simply for giving reward, right? So he says that, does that make sense logically? That meta system. Yes, no? Yes, right? So that the mitzvot shimiyot, the laws that didn't inherently make sense, they don't inherently make sense, but they make sense in the broader picture, right? They fit into category four, the things that God created for the sole purpose of rewarding us because he wants to reward us, right? So you see that it's very subtle here. And this is what I said, that the difference between him and Rabbeinu Bachya, right, you see, it's all a question of when you're categorizing something, it's all a question of what do you think the categories should reflect. For him, it's not logical, illogical. It's, would I have known it? Would I not have known it? Right? Could I have figured it out or not? Right? Because everything for him is logical, both on the meta level, and then at the end, he says, not even the meta level, but even on the, not just in the macro, but in the micro. But still there's a difference because the mitzvah shimiyot, right, I can only post facto come up for a justification with. I couldn't have intuited it, but okay, once I know it's true, so I'll come up with an explanation.
But if there, if there is a reason, then it means there is a reason for it.
Correct, right? He never says there's anything, right? That's what I said. It's totally epistemological. He never says there's something that has no reason, right? He doesn't take the Rashi approach that chukim are things that have no reason and mishpatim are things with reason, right? He never says that, right? He says there's shimiot v'sichliot. There's things I could have figured out and things I couldn't. But even the things I couldn't have figured out, post facto, I can justify, right? This distinction that you have from Rashi, that's where it comes from, that chukim are things with no reason and mishpatim are things with reason, Rasagagon just doesn't buy into. Again, it's totally epistemological. It's totally how did I know it, not what are their nature once they exist. Okay? Right? So I think this is a very subtle, right? It's a very, very sharp system, and you see how it's not just that it's very, very subtle, but you see how it follows what? His introduction, right? He's systematic. Remember, he said, in order to know things, what's critical? You know what you're looking for, you know how to look for it, and you do it with care and watch him implement it, right? He's saying there's two types of knowledge. There's the first three, which you use in general, and then there's tradition. All of them are logical because tradition is derived from the first three, right? That's exactly what he's doing here. The things you derive from the first three are mitzvah sichlio. Things you only know through tradition are logical to keep. They make sense in the macro, but right, they're derivative. I know them through Mesorah. I know them through tradition, so they're not directly epistemologically accessible, right? But it's not about being illogical, because then at the end of the day, he backtracks and says, and even they have an inherent logic if you just look for it. Right? So this, I think, is a very subtle picture of the mitzvah. Right? It's very careful. It follows his own methodology of how to know things. Right? And he's very careful in his distinctions. Right? He sticks with it from the beginning. Right? He says there are four ways of knowing things, and they are fundamentally different. They're all logical, but they're different. Look, this is how they apply the mitzvah. Right? And you see his claim that in order to know, you need to be systematic. Right, he is true to his word and he does it, which is very impressive about Rasagagon. Right, he's very systematic in that way and very, very careful. Okay, so that's like the two main claims. But you see now why you had to learn the introduction to understand that, right, his claim of Simeon Tzichlia is not random. Right, it follows his logic of what it means to know things. Okay, so now, right, to the end, I've just basically given you a bunch of examples. So let's run through them. I won't read through all of them. And you can see them, and you can, you know, because you can quibble on some of his reasons for Tamei HaMitzvot here and there, right? But the main claim is important. So let's just, right, continue, right? We'll skip around paragraphs, but, right? Okay. It is proper that I should, and again, I can send you the whole thing if you want. You know, not a problem. Okay. It is proper that I should first and foremost discuss the rational law. So wisdom suggests, now some of it you'll find very obvious. Wisdom suggests that bloodshed should be prevented amongst human beings. For if it were allowed, people would annihilate each other. Straightforward? Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's straightforward. That would mean, apart from the pain suffered, a frustration of the purpose which the wise intend to achieve through them, homicide cuts them from the attainment of any purpose he created and employs them for. Wisdom for this suggests prohibition of adultery. For otherwise, human beings would become similar to animals. Okay, not quite as obvious. Right? Remember, we saw in the Ramban, he wasn't convinced that adultery was something you would know naturally, but Rasagagon thinks it is. No person would be able to know and honor his father in return for education he received his hands. Right? He said it's very simple. If there was adultery, people wouldn't know their parents. And there's a certain basic civic purpose to people knowing their parents, right? You know who your parents are, who educated you, who you owe your life to, etc. Nor would a father be able to bequeath his son a means of a livelihood. He said, look, the family unit makes sense. Right, the best way to get a job, the best way to be educated in life is to have a parent, or have a father who's taking care of you, a mother who's taking care of you. So, you know what? The notion of having a family unit and protecting it through laws of adultery, that makes a lot of sense. Right? You wouldn't get inheritance, you wouldn't know your relatives, you wouldn't be able to show them kindness due to relatives, right? He assumes that there's a certain goodness, and this is, you know, if you want a very systematic treatment of this, you can look at Adam Smith. Right, the notion that there's actually inherent benefit to the concentric circles of kindness, right, of beneficence, right, that there are people you treat with justice, which are the outskirts of your social circle, and people you treat with beneficence, and that's what's expected, right? The way you train yourself in beneficence is having the concentric circle of, right, your family, your friends, etc., right, that it trains you in how to distinguish between beneficence and justice. He said there's a certain benefit to having family members that you can show kindness to. Now he says something very, very surprising about theft. I would have say that theft, why would you have said that theft is logical? The prohibition against theft is logical?
Because property belongs to
someone. Right, that's what I would have said. Just property belongs to someone, you can't take it. He actually says something different, which I find very surprising, which is wisdom further suggests the prohibition of theft, for if it were permitted, some people would rely on it as their ability to steal some other people's property and would not do any productive work nor amass wealth. Right, he says the problem with theft is it discourages people from being productive. Right? Because if you could take something from him, then you won't try to produce yourself. I think that's a fascinating claim. I don't know if that's what I would have said logically, but fine. Right, in the next paragraph he says that it's just logical that we tell the truth. Okay, you know, we can skip around. Yeah, skip to the next page, okay? Right, you can look through these yourself. The second class of law concerns such matters that are of a neutral character. Right, let's now move to mitzvot shimiyot. Right, okay, so mitzvot sichliyot we can distinguish. Fine, mitzvot shimiyot, the things that are neutral from the point of reason, but which the law has made the object of commandment in some cases and a prohibition in others, leaving the rest in their neutral state. Instances are, or what are classic examples? What would you put in this? What? Kashrus. What else?
Shabbos.
What else?
Shabbos.
Shabbos, Kashrus. Yeah, that's what he said, right? Instances are Shabbos, the festivals, right? The selection of certain individuals to be prophets and leaders, the prohibition to eat certain foodstuffs, right? Kashrus. The avoidance of sexual intercourse with certain people, right? Some of the arayos he put in the first category, some he puts here, right? Not all of them are inherently logical. Some aren't. Right, the fact that right, it's uncle and aunt only works in one direction. Right, you know, those you might not have known. The great motive for the observance of these principles and laws derived and branching out for them is, of course, the command of our Lord and the promotion of our happiness resulting from it. But I find for most of them also, and now this is important for him. Right, what did he say? Not just are they logical. They're not just shimiyot, but they are logical post facto. Right, but again, think epistemologically the difference. Right. The first set of mitzvot, I could know without it being commanded. The second ones, once they exist, they make sense. But that doesn't mean I could figure it out, right? For example, right? I wish to point out and discuss some of them, realizing that I do that God's wisdom is above all this, right? And he notes that in these, is he making a firm claim about the reason for them? No, right? That's what he's prefacing, right? God is above us. It's not that he's saying, look, this is the reason. I don't know. It's not something I could have derived logically. I'm now trying. I'm saying there's some logic to it. If I'm wrong, okay, I'm wrong. Right? Big deal. Right? In the end, I keep it because I obey God, and there's a value to obeying God, because God wanted to give me reward because I have a relationship with him, and that makes sense in the macro. In the micro, okay, I get it. I get the reason right? Great. I don't get the reason right? Okay, also fine. Right? Not a big deal. So he said, the distinction confirmed at certain times has these advantages. In the first place, it enables us to desist from our work at certain times and obtain a rest from any other travails. So he said, the notion that there's Shabbos and Yom Tov makes sense. A day of rest makes sense. Furthermore, to enjoy the pleasures of learned pursuits and have the benefit of additional prayer, there's also advantage that people will be free to meet at gatherings, discuss matters concerning their religion, proclaim them in public. Right? It gives you time to rest. It gives you time to devote to important things. Then he says, right, that there are advantages to giving people different statuses. Right, because it allows people to devote themselves to specific roles. Right, you can argue on it. He thinks that the reason for kashrus is it prevents you from thinking of animals as gods. Right, the fact that God right, in the ancient world where animals were worshipped, and even now a little bit. Right, the fact that God says which animals are holy and which are not, it clearly puts God in charge of the animals. Right, we can quibble about these. Right, you see, he's not making firm claims about it. He's saying, look, I think there's some logic to it. Okay, so we'll skip. You know, you can read the rest yourself. So just to summarize these points again, we said the introduction. Right, he makes two main points. Right, one is that there are in order to know things, you have to be careful. You have to know how to get that. You have to know how to figure it out. You have to know what you're looking for. And the second thing is, what are the ways of knowing things? There are four parts to it, right? All the logical things, right? Plus senses, plus authority, plus tradition. Tradition is a secondary thing. He carries this over to mitzvos, right? The things that could be derived from logic are Sichliot, the things which are only derived from tradition, are fundamentally shimmiot, or fundamentally not inherently logical, but even they have a logic, right? But they're not as important, because really it's about getting reward, right? He has his four reasons for mitzvot in general: to thank God, to not disrespect God, to not hurt each other, and then, right, to simply, God gave us mitzvot to reward us. Shimmiot basically fall in the last category. And that's where we are at this point. The last point, which he says, which is very famous, and I'll summarize it for you outside, is the necessity of revelation. Right, why is that we need revelation? So this is just important to know. And basically he says, look, even... right, revelation has two roles, really. One is the things we couldn't have known logically. Right, we already saw that. But he says there's another thing, which is that even things that you could have known logically, it takes shorter... once you have revelation, right? If every generation had to reestablish things from first principles, you would never get anywhere. So he says that once you've already established through the first three principles that it's legitimate to listen to revelation, to listen to tradition, so then it's logical to follow tradition, so it's a shortcut to know a lot of things, right? So once he's established his principles, right, he can say that, by the way, there's an added benefit now to revelation, that because it is itself logical, it allows us to circumvent the long process and not reinvent the wheel every generation, which is an important claim, right? In addition to, obviously, that revelation gives us things we wouldn't have known, it also gives us things we could figure out, it just shortcuts it. Okay? So, that's, I think, probably the most famous passages in Ur-Sajigon. And again, you see how, as the first person really writing on these topics in a systematic way, he's extremely careful in terms of methodology, in terms of defining categories, in terms of following that methodology and using those categories consistently throughout the book, right? So that a picture develops both on the macro level and the micro level. And he's clear about the different strength of arguments he's making, those that are mukhrach, those that you have to believe because they're inherent from logic, those that are not. Right? He's very, very careful and develops what I think is a very, very, if not the only view, but at least a very compelling view of the system of Torah as a whole. I mean, his end claim about revelation is also very striking, because it goes back to those original claims about how you know things. But it also goes a long way in explaining why, right, we have those different types of knowledge, and why it's important that revelation and traditions itself based on the first three, because it makes it that it's not illogical to circumvent the process, because in the end of the day, it's based on the same first principles that all knowledges in the world are based of. Okay, so that's Ur-Sajigon. Good. Stay there. Safe.